unusual talk. There was a lot of, well, let me start it this way. Once upon a time, we scientists thought we knew what we were doing, and thought we knew how science works. Then there was this thing called science wars, where we understood that there were some people that overtook us as their professional objects of study. And the first response of that was, oh my God, you know, these people think they know something about us. This is if somebody who truly has one personal life. And there was quite a hubbub. And in the hubbub, which I was witnessing, every once in a while you would hear, well, they're all crazy, but there's one or two that you can talk to. Harry Collins was always mentioned at that point. Although, if one went and looked at what he was saying, it was pretty extreme, at that time. At least it seemed to me at first pretty extreme. But in any case, he was certainly distinguished as one of the leaders of the people from the field of social science who was studying us and had interesting things to say. And then, sometime in the last year, a book appeared, which was a long 700-page, is that right? 870-page study of the history of the effort to detect gravitational wave, which was detailed and serious and scholarly, and I was sent that to review. And somewhere, partway through reading it, I realized that this was the same person as this radical science studies person who everybody had been screaming about, but occasionally were saying is reasonable and we can talk to. And it turned out that all this time, he really had been studying scientists. And really, judging from the book, really kind of understood something about how we work. So I thought it would be fun to invite him, since there was a lot of interest in history and philosophy of science, and have somebody with the audacity, and even in the last day, it's been clear, and the confidence to really tell us what it is that we're doing. Or at least tell us that we may not know everything about what we're doing. So we're very, very happy to have him here to tell us about the sociology of science. Thank you.
Thanks. That's one of the nice things about what I've had. I really enjoyed that. You can see if I write this board. The trouble with being a sociologist, the trouble with sociology is two drinks in this enterprise. This creates some problems. I mean, the other thing that's been said about sociology and the philosophy of science, studies of science in general, as I was said by Steve Weinberg, quoting Feynman, Richard Feynman, is that, well, I think he actually was referring to philosophy of science, he said the philosophy of science is as much use to scientists as ornithology is to birds. My immediate quip when I hear this is say, yeah, that's probably right. So if you want to know about ornithology, go and ask birds. But the trouble is that birds think they know about ornithology because birds take a couple of drinks now and again. So it's a common experience of mine. If I come to talk to scientists who don't know me, they immediately tell me how science works. And when I say, well, no, it's not quite like that, they say, no, you're talking rubbish, we know how it works. And this makes for a very rich academic life, because it's always interesting to be opposing other people because you know you've got something to say. If you're never in doubt, well, at least maybe wrong, but at least there's something there to say. But I'm afraid it makes for a very rich personality. So my apologies to those people who I've already insulted in my very short stay here. But it's, you know, sometimes I react like that when please tell me how it works. Now, I've been a sociologist of science, what's called a sociologist of scientific knowledge, since the early 1970s. And during this time, I've done a number of case studies, studying people building transversely excited atmospheric pressure, carbon dioxide lasers. I've studied people doing parapsychology. I've studied, or at least failed to study, people looking at the theory of the amorphous semiconductors. I failed to study it because I never understand a single word they were saying. I have kind of studied artificial intelligence. I've actually written two books about artificial intelligence, though actually I like to think I'm more of an aspiring contributor in that area rather than somebody who's doing case studies on it, because I think I actually know something about knowledge and I know something about why computers won't be able to capture it. But most of it, I spent more time than anything else on this case study of gravitational wave detection, which I stumbled on in 1972 when I was a graduate student doing my PhD. It was one of the case studies I picked for my PhD. I went and talked to all the guys doing it in 1972, then in 1975, carried on doing fieldwork until 1976, wrote up the papers, including the probably one of the crazy ones that you're referring to subsequently. But then, in the mid-1990s, I sort of kept an eye on gravitational waves. In the mid-1990s, I got back into it full time. For about 10 years, the last 10 years, since the mid-1990s, I've been studying the gravitational wave community almost full time, going to all their meetings and conferences and so on. And the result, part of the result of this is this massive, great book that came out a year ago. And I've just come, in fact, before I came, my reason for being in North America is that I was at MIT at the latest LIGO scientific collaboration meeting, listening to the latest developments in the field. I was there a couple of days ago. So I thought I might just start, in case anybody's interested, telling you about the current state of the art of gravitational wave detection. For anybody who knows the story, that's Jerry Weber, who started the whole thing off in the 1970s. He's generally reckoned that Jerry Weber claimed to have seen gravitational waves, but it's generally agreed that he was making a mistake. And my book, about half my book, or a third of my book, is about Jerry Weber's story, how it came about, that nobody believed him any longer. Following Jerry Weber, there was a long period when people used the basic idea of Jerry Weber's design, which is one of his resonant aluminium bars with piezoelectric crystal fluid to the surface. The next generation of detectors was cryogenically cooled bars. That went on for quite a few years. During the course of this, about 15 unsuccessful claims of seen gravitational waves have been made. And now we are in the era of big interferometers. And we no doubt are familiar with this kind of thing. This is the big interferometer in Livingston, Louisiana. One of the American ones, another one in Hanford. And these are the two interferometers in the LIGO project, Laser Interferometer Gravitational Observatory. So let me just tell you where these things are. The modern way to describe the state of play with interferometers is to describe their range. And that is the range at which they will be able to see an inspiral binary neutron star system in the last few seconds of its life, when the neutron stars are each 1.4 solar masses, and the orientation of the system is the sort of mean orientation that it can have, not the best orientation, not the worst orientation, but somewhere in the middle. LIGO currently, each individual, one of the LIGO detectors at the moment has a range of about 12 megaparsecs, one of them around about 11. The duty cycle's coming up. If you want to know what the range of a pair of them is, you have to take the square root of the sum of the squares of the ranges. The design sensitivity is 14 megaparsecs for each one. So they're not quite there. Is that the design sensitivity? There's a sociological story about whether that's the design sensitivity or not. In fact, everybody's just decided that LIGO was well past its design sensitivity, because when they went back and looked at the documents, they discovered that the official design sensitivity was a lot less than that. So everybody's very happy with LIGO, though people have been talking about this other 14 megaparsecs design sensitivity for several years. But LIGO is, it's really good, and it's almost miraculously worked. Lots of people think it's never worked. Yeah. And it's doing very, very well. There is a network of detectors. The next most biggest one is Virgo, which is in Italy, a joint French-Italian project. And they're hoping that in about next spring they'll have a range of 5 megaparsecs. And then there's another one, a smaller one in Hanover called GeoSatellite, which will have a range when it's working well of about 2 to 3 megaparsecs. But LIGO is much nearer to design sensitivity than the other two. What's called S5, the latest LIGO scientific run, intend to keep LIGO on air now for 18 months or so if they can. Hope to get the duty cycle up to about 75%, and really look for gravitational waves. By next spring, they hope, when Virgo is more sensitive, they hope they'll be doing 4 interferometer search, integrating the data from all 4 interferometers and using that. The LIGO is going to be the most sensitive instrument, obviously. Nevertheless, if there's a very powerful band, goes on all 4 or 3 and so on. People in the community are quite optimistic at the moment. One's always optimistic, I suppose, when your instrument gets another step, gains another step in sensitivity, you start looking again. But also estimates of sources have gone up a bit recently. And very recently, NASA, as you probably know, announced that they found some short, hard gamma ray bursts. And LIGO's interested in this, and NASA's interested in LIGO, because LIGO can tell that these short, hard gamma ray bursts come from neutron star binaries or neutron star black hole binaries, because the gravitational wave signature will be different depending on the interferometer. So suddenly LIGO finds itself in a bit of new limelight with astronomers who hated it for most of its lifetime. It's so expensive.
Can I ask a question about that last one? What is the total cost in the end of the whole project?
Say $300 million. Okay, but it depends exactly how you do the accountancy. Different countries do their accountancy in different ways, but $300 million. This is very nice. I've written this book. I'm hoping to hang around and stay in contact with the field until the final detection of gravitational waves has been agreed to be made. And then I want to compare that final detection of gravitational waves with 15 or so other detections, each of which I've studied pretty carefully to see how they were, how it was decided that they weren't really gravitational wave detections. Now with a bit of, how long have I got? I've got to ask that.
We go roughly an hour.
So if I, I'll think about calling out 20 minutes for questions, is that right?
No, we sort of go, a talk is 15 minutes to an hour, and then we have questions after that.
Oh, off the hour.
Yeah. Oh, okay. If you're very lucky, you'll have questions throughout, and then we'll deal with it in the half phase.
Sorry. Yeah. Let me just say that this project, I've been doing it for a long time, it's led me in all kinds of different directions, and my most recent interest is in expertise. And what I'm hoping to do is when I circle around back to this expertise business at the end of the talk, because there's plenty to argue about. But the thing that's triggered my interest in expertise, originally triggered, is you start to think, oh, how am I doing this project? Here am I spending all my time talking to gravitational wave scientists, but I don't know degree in science. I'm an aspirant. I can't do gravitational wave scientists. Now I'll tell you a secret. Remember I was telling you about the range of the interferometers, 12 megaparsecs, 11 megaparsecs, dividing the range of the two by taking the square root of the sum of the square and so on. I don't know what a megaparsec is. Look it up. I know it's a range. I don't know if you could translate it into light years. You might look up and see how many light years it was. But right here and now, at this moment in time, I don't know what a megaparsec is. Okay. And I don't know why it's called. There have been times when I've known what a megaparsec is. This particular moment, I don't. So you see, in a sense, I can't do the science. And as I've been saying to people over the last couple of days, I can talk the talk, but I can't walk the walk. And this is an interesting situation to be in. I'm kind of puzzled about it. But, I can talk the talk reasonably well, but it's sort of puzzling. Let me just some of your colleagues have told me that what I am is basically a bullshitter.
We said that about the people you observe.
But I'm afraid this is one of the things that tempt me to give a sort of short reply. But let me try and illustrate the sense in which I am talking. Here's what happened to me at this meeting. I was sitting listening to them talking about this new exciting possibility of detecting gravitational waves in coincidence with gamma ray bursts. And at one point they said, yeah, we can get the list of the gamma ray bursts for the Swift satellite. But isn't there another list which isn't made public, which is of the non-gold-plated events? That is to say, events that look a bit like gamma ray bursts, but they're not quite sure they are, so they don't actually announce them in public. Somebody says, yeah, there is a list of these non-gold-plated events which we could get if we dug a bit deeper. And they say, well, we should look for gravitational waves in coincidence with the non-gold-plated events as well. And everybody said, yeah. And I turned to, that's what you see, to seats away from me, fairly senior guy in the field. I said, Alan, why are you doing this? Is this because the gamma ray bursts are beamed, whereas the gravitational wave bursts aren't beamed? So you might, one of the non-gold-plated events could be an event where you're adjusting the edge of the beam, but it could still be good gravitational, good strong gravitational wave. And he said, yeah, that's right. So that's the sort of conversation. Then this morning in the shower, I was thinking about this, because I was going over this talk in my head. And I said this, and I suddenly thought, hey, wait a minute, there's something funny here. Isn't it the case that I have seen computer-generated pictures of gamma ray bursts given off by a system like this? And if I remember right, the beam is at right angles to the plane of the orbit of the insulfuran object. So that means that if we're in the centre of the beam, I thought to myself, if we're in the centre of the beam, we're not going to see any gravity waves because that's the most unfavourable orientation to see gravity waves from as far as the binary neutrons. So I thought to myself, wait a minute, that means there's going to be an inverse relationship between, if you normalise the distance, it could be that there's an inverse relationship between the strength of the gravitational wave and the strength of the gamma ray burst. And, you know, I can see that the actual function will depend on exactly the imputed angle of the beam and the way it drops off as you get to the edge and so on and so forth. So what I would normally have done is gone to my desk and emailed one of my mates in the gravitational wave field, asked this question, said, what's going on here? Is this right or wrong? They would have normally, if they hadn't, they would have replied more or less straight away, put me in set me right or whatever. But I decided not to do that, so I decided to ask you instead. Just to give it, just to sort of make it live, so you can see people talking and talking about walking and walking to life. So what is that? Is it true that the gamma ray burst is at right angles to the plane of the orbit?
Not sure if anyone here uses sufficient expertise to answer that.
Well, the gamma ray burst can be in the plane of the orbit. It's along the tangent to the, if it's going around, if the particle's spiraling in, the burst is along the tangent. It's not perpendicular to the orbit.
Oh, is that right? In that case, so my imagined problem when I was in the shower this morning was just completely misplaced.
Well, that's the natural direction.
I mean, what decides which direction it's in? If it's at a tangent, it could be in any one of 360 degrees.
We only see a certain line of sight.
No, but I mean, what would be the physical cause of it coming off in one direction rather than another?
I have to think about the mechanism that produces the gamma ray burst.
Yeah.
If you think about that, then you'll know the answer.
That's what you have to do. I mean, my kind of vague reasoning is that it's likely to be in some sort of unique direction, and the only unique direction is normal to the plane of the orbit. If it comes off at a tangent, then it's kind of arbitrary where it comes off. But I don't know, maybe I'm, you know, I will send the email.
The problem is that there's no consensus yet as to what the mechanism is that produces the gamma ray burst.
Ah.
So if you don't know that, how do you know which direction it goes off?
Okay.
One explanation is it's like a thermonuclear explosion in the surface of the object.
Okay.
And the problem is that it's extremely bright, and it's extra electric.
Well, what I'll do is, when I after the talk, I'll go back and I'll email somebody, and maybe I'll find the answer, and I'll tell them. But that's how it works. That's how being a sociologist in a field like this works. If you're the sort of sociologist who thinks you should know something about science, which is, I'm that kind of sociologist. I couldn't do the sociology of the theory of morphic semantic patterns because I couldn't understand it at all. And I couldn't do the sociology of the sort of theoretical physics that you do here because I can't understand it at all. It's a terrible mystery. It's a shame. I'd really like to understand it. Maybe one day I will. I could try and find out something about understanding it at the moment. Anyway, that's an illustration of what I think. Now, let me sort of explain what my kind of problematic is. I'm going to draw LIGO's logo for you. I've got a baseball cap with it on, issued by LIGO when it was a commemoration of this institution. This is some astrophysical event, like a couple of inspiring black holes or supernova, and these are gravity waves emanating from it. And then in my book, I add to this diagram and I draw a gravity wave detector on the surface of the Earth. And then, you know, so here we are, something goes off, ripples in space-time, hit the gravity wave detector. And then I ask, now what happens when they hit the gravity wave detector? Well, what happens when they hit the gravity wave detector is people in the lab say, hey look, our gravity wave detector has jumped a bit, there's some bit more noise in the signal than we thought they were. Let's have a closer look and see if we can, is this really a signal? Is there a coincidence? We saw this at Hanford, is there a coincidence with Livingston? Well, yeah, there was a bit of coincidence, yeah. That seemed to have a kind of interesting waveform that could be inspired by a neutron star. Anything of Virgo? No, nothing there, it's too weird. Okay. But nevertheless, it still looks interesting. Let's have a little conference, an LSE conference. Let's have a teleconference, first of all, to see if the guys think this is worth talking about. Yeah, it's worth talking about more. Okay, we'll talk about it at the LSE. Yes, we should publish it, we should write an initial write-up of this and vet it. 20,000 people will look at the paper and make sure there's no mistake. Yeah, okay, let's put it on our electronic web server. Okay, yeah, still hasn't suffered any too great criticism. Okay, let's put it in FizzRev letters. Okay, yeah, it goes into FizzRev letters. What's happening here is that there are rituals in social space time. Right, here we are, this is the electronic preprint server, this is physical review letters. This is really grim, isn't it, Carl? Okay. It finally hits the Guardian, and it's only when it finally hits the Guardian that gravitational waves have been discovered. This is scientists' sphere, this is sociologists' sphere. How does it get from here to the Guardian? How does it get through all these stages? What's the actual process? That's what the sociologist looks at in great detail. Now I'm going to take a shortcut, something that people might want to talk about more later in the question session. And just point out some elementary feature of this diagram. I've described this diagram in terms of the causal arrow going this way from some astrophysical event to the detector and out to the Gulf. But since we don't know gravitational waves have been discovered for the test of the Guardian newspaper, you could equally well draw the arrow the other way. That in fact, gravitational waves don't exist until gravitational waves are in the Gulf. That's relevant. That's what the science was. People talking about the causal arrow going this way, rather than that way. Now, depending how crazy you were, excuse me, I put it that way to pander to you. Depending how crazy you were, you could really believe that's how the world was, that it ran this way. And I can assure you it is possible to support that point of view. Yeah. But if you wanted to present yourself as less crazy, as I do nowadays. What I actually say is it actually doesn't matter which way the galaxy goes. It's like a big bang. It's same causal mechanism to work, whether it's forward in time or backward in time. But, if you're a sociologist, you better think about the arrow going this way. Because if you think about the arrow going this way, if you want to ask the question, how did this get to the garden? The answer you're going to give is being overburdened. It's going to be overburdened by the following reasoning. It got to the garden because gravity waves were really there and really discovered. And then you don't do your job. Because your job is just to study this bit of it. And this bit of it is irrelevant if you want to study this bit of it. If you start doing this in your causal mechanism, you're going to wind up with a circular explanation. People believe this because it's true. That's not sociology. What you've got to study is this kind of mechanism, so you have to, just like any good scientist, partial out the cause that you're not interested in. Yeah? The truth is held constant, right? And the proper kind of explanation between there and there should look exactly the same, except for a few minor details, whether this is true or whether it's not true. So all my studies of how Joe Weber's gravity waves can be not accepted as the truth will be very similar in time to my description of how gravity waves come to be accepted, but there'll just be a few little differences. And those little differences might be sociologically interesting.
But it doesn't always make the Guardian that something is not accepted.
It might get that far. It doesn't affect the future much.
But they're not big on announcing a month later that a certain modern idea has been subsequently shown to be wrong.
That's true. And that's another, the way that the media handles science is another whole climate. Let me just say what you see if you really start to examine what happens here. One of the first things you discover is that experiments just don't work as the normal story of science tells you they ought to work. And the reason they don't work is very, very, very simple and can be worked out by just a reflection of your own experience of doing experiments at school, high school. And if you remember, think back to your own experience of doing experiments, high school, undergraduate experiments, and all that, you will remember that they almost never work. Certainly not first time, anyway. Even the simplest experiment of the whole lot, that's the first you ever did, which was to check the boiling point of water didn't work, because nobody ever finds a 100% centigrade. But the right, this very clever trick that the teacher does, you all believe going out of the class and thinking you have proof. Water boils at 100 degrees centigrade, whereas if you prove anything, it's the opposite, but it doesn't boil at 100 degrees centigrade. But most of the experiments don't work, so what do? Well, you carry on with the experiment until it appears to have worked, and what it means by what period of work means is that you get a result in the acceptable range. So to know whether you've done an experiment right or not, you have to know what an acceptable range is for the result. Now, this is difficult when you don't know what the acceptable rate is. So in the case of, for instance, gravitational wave detectors, Joe Weber was building. He built his gravitational wave detector, he said he saw gravitational waves. His rivals built gravitational wave detectors and said they didn't see gravitational waves with theirs. Joe Weber says that's because he hadn't built the gravitational wave detector right. If you built it smoothly, you would see gravitational waves. They said no. You've made some mistake in your gravitational wave detector or your analysis of your gravitational wave detector, and if you build your gravitational wave detector, you would see gravitational wave. You wouldn't see gravitational wave. Okay. How do you sell this argument? Well, you have to know whether there are any gravitational waves. Can you find out whether there are any gravitational waves? Well, you have to build a damn good gravitational wave detector to have a look. How do you know whether it's a damn good gravitational wave detector? Well, you have to know whether there's any gravitational waves. How do you goes round and round in circles. This thing called what I call experimental regress. To know whether the experiment works, you have already to know the result. to know the result, we have to know that your experiment works. And this is how experiment actually is in contested areas of science. And the decisions that people make about whether an experiment has worked or not have to, it's not a choice, they have to rest on a whole lot of, as one might say, non-scientific reasoning. I see this result, do I trust it? Or do I trust the person who built the experiment? How do I know whether to trust this person? Oh, it's okay, I knew it when I was an undergraduate. He was a good guy. Bad guy. Okay. Oh, he comes from that institution, nothing good ever came out of that. I don't believe that. Yeah. Oh, somebody I know went to work in his lab for a while and he said there are lots of latest things going on there. Don't believe that. Yeah. Or vice versa. And I collected scientists' reasons for making their decision about whether they were going to believe in Joe Webb's results or believe in his rival's results, and they were all along these lines. It all turned on trust. It has to turn on trust because you're not feeling that authority. You're not doing that experiment, even if you do your own experiment to decide to settle it, you don't know whether your own experiment works or not. If it's a really difficult experiment. Now people try to find all sorts of shortcuts and ways into this experimental progress. They try calibration, so for instance in the early gravitational wave days, people try to calibrate their detectors with the electrostatic pulses to see which detector is the most sensitive to that. But maybe the electrostatic pulse isn't the right waveform for the gravitational wave. Or maybe electrostatic pulses didn't interact with the aluminium of the barn quite as well as the gravitational wave. You know, they were local pulses rather than pulses which affected the whole material. And you can, whichever way you take it, the argument goes on and on and on. And serious scientific controversies have the capacity to go on forever. If you want to settle them by absolute logic. So.
Well, there is an experimental physics, there is the issue of the repetitive result. When you do the experiment every 52 times and you get the same answer in different ways. Yeah. In the end, you believe it. You're like,
well, you might be, you know, or you might not. For instance,
it hurts and measures the electromagnetic waves.
Okay.
Then it was done 168 different ways, and we now have electromagnetic waves.
Yeah. Well, the same applies.
There's no question about it.
Okay, I mean, you might argue that the same applies, shall we say, to result in parapsychology, where the existence of paranormal effects has been proven by experiments with very, very, very good statistical backup. Over and over and over and over again. Repeated and repeated and repeated. But my guess is that probably nobody did believe it. So it isn't just repetition that makes you believe. You believe that every single one of those multiply repeated parapsychological experiments had a systematic flaw in it. And you believe it without examining it in your time.
John, let's do the full argument. We have lots of time to.
So, what I'm saying is that if you're determined enough and you just stick to this, you reach these sorts of conclusions. The experiment doesn't just do it, just like that. I told a story at lunch. The story at lunch the other day was a Michael Samoli experiment, which everybody knows very well. It was done in 1987. It didn't manage to detect any velocity of movement of the Earth through the ether.
1887.
1887, velocity of Earth through the ether as a function of which way the interferometer measured the speed of light, blah, 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 blah. And everybody has completely forgotten what actually those disputes about that experiment went right up to beyond the 1930s, because in the 1930s the most definitive review article said that there was an ether drift. But everybody's finally forgotten that story. It's always the whole experiment. It took about 40 years to stop arguing about the compromise. And you can read about that in the other book that I certainly follow very cool to go in, which has that science. So here's the experimental progression. The odd thing is that, this is not, I don't want people to misunderstand what I'm saying. This is not a criticism of science. I'm not producing criticism of science. I'm actually a science lover. If I wasn't a science lover, I wouldn't have stuck around with it the whole of my life and enjoyed it every single minute. I loved it to do the LIGO installations, talking to LIGO pieces, and so on and so forth.
And I think it, I don't think there's any better way to do science than the way it's done. You know, we made a few marginal adjustments here and there, but basically science is great. It's just that it isn't the way people normally describe it, slightly differently. It's the best you can do. It's got any better way of doing it. It's the best you can do. But one of the features of science is that in the case of a scientific controversy, sometime or other you've got to draw it to an end, even when every single loophole hasn't been closed. If you try, you know, every time you try to close a new loophole, as an ingenious resistor can find another loophole. It's like Tantalus's task. Final absolute certainty will always recede, just as you think to reach towards it. So eventually the mechanism by which scientific get closed is that the mavericks who are holding up one idea die. But Planck said, science progresses funeral by funeral, and everybody else just gets tired, and it isn't worth pursuing it anymore. Okay. But those final loopholes are never quite closed. And so that opens the way for the sociologist to describe the mechanism of closure. In the case of the Joe Weber business, it was basically, I believe, according to my account, it was closed by Dick Gardner, who built a very, very small one of the Grossman bars and just wrote up did his analysis in a very careful way, and wrote it up in a very fortified way, went to a conference and shouted very loud that Joe Weber found absolutely nothing at all, although it was bullshit. Joe Weber made a few serious mistakes, which other people were prepared to give him for, but Dick Darwin wasn't. And he, as it were, crystallized this mass of tentative opinion that's going against Weber into one solid thing. And after that, everybody knew that a gravitational wave detector of Joe Weber's sensitivity had better not see gravity waves, otherwise it was going to be counted as a defective piece of apparatus and associated defective analysis. So it was a sort of historic moment. Now, I said I'm now going to give you sort of a list of things that are in this big fat book. A list of sort of incidental discoveries on why devoted to gravitational work being discovered. One of the things that I discovered is that physics, and you probably already know this, you may not really understand if it's true, physics doesn't really turn very much on what the quality of the journey. It doesn't really turn very much on what the quality of the journey. Primitive setting, it actually turns on what people say to each other. Physics is an oral culture. Let me give you an example. In 1996, Joe Weber published a paper in Rovercimento, the journal, in which he said that he had found a correlation between the gravitational waves he had claimed to have detected and what I talked about earlier, gamma ray bursts. Mm-hmm. Okay. And he said that there were only 6 chances in 100,000 that the results were due to chance. Okay, in this paper. A momentous result. Gravitational waves correlated with gamma ray bursts. I spent a lot of time thinking about this paper and talking to people about this paper and asked more or less everybody in the gravitational wave community, by then a few hundred strong, about this paper. And what I discovered was that only 3 people in the world had read this paper. Joe Weber, the editor of Rovercimento, and me. There was this paper in the journal saying the correlation between gamma ray bursts and gravitational waves, and nobody read it. Because Joe Weber by that time was not any longer a scientist to be taken notice of. His credibility disappeared. And he could still publish papers. I mean, the physics community on this kind of thing, they're very generous to his papers. They actually, I mean, I'm quite surprised that somebody pointed out those kids, oh, that physics is much, Hithorn's life is in social sciences, and he says that physics is actually much more ready to publish typical papers in people don't like than social sciences. But a wrong paper comes in, we'll refer it, we'll try and persuade the author to change it, but if they won't change it, in the end it's his neck or her neck, not ours. So let us publish the wrong paper that they really want. Well, that's true if you'd like to, well, if you haven't got any status or fame, it's probably not quite so true. But there are more, there are quite a few wrong papers out there, as you probably know. I'm sure you can think about other incidents. So, and it doesn't, in a sense, it doesn't really matter that those wrong papers are out there, because physics being an oral culture, everybody knows what to take notes on and what not to take notes on. So they're not fooled by these wrong papers. The strange situation is that if you came from another planet and you decided you wanted to understand terrestrial science by reading the journals, you'd probably get the physics. Because you wouldn't know if it's Joe Webber paper, so you weren't supposed to take notes on it. So, in order to get terrestrial science properly, you have to be within the appropriate piece of oral culture.
That oral culture is also reflected in the written culture, in the sense that the papers that people ignore don't get cited, right? The papers that people like, other people build on other papers.
You might be able to reconstruct the right science from the citations.
Maybe not all of it, but
there's, there's going to be sort of a number of streams of science as well. So, for instance, you find lots of citations to cold fusion, for example.
That's right, but I suspect you could still reconstruct a lot of it from larger scale structure.
Let's put it this way. You've got to be right, because you can eventually reconstruct from the textbooks once it's all digested and filtered down. So you must be right. There must be some mechanism. But what I'm saying is that the research frontier, you're not going to find out from reading the papers. So you've got to know. Here's a cafeteria of odd findings. Joe Webber's paper, the paper that Joe Webber published in 1996, wasn't even read by anybody. But earlier, in the mid-1980s, he published other, his results were more or less rejected by everybody in 1975. In the mid-1980s, he did some more rather curious work. He decided that the problem was that he had the wrong theory of the cross-section of a bar detector. And that if you worked out the cross-section of the bar detector properly, it was about 9 orders of magnitude more sensitive. And this explained the anomaly, and then he could also go on to explain why his one was more sensitive than the other ones which were built. It was something to do with exactly where you put the transducer, which had to be a Webber-type transducer, and everybody else used a different kind of transducer. And furthermore, he said that this result applied not only to gravitational waves, but also to neutrinos, and that with his new theory, a small crystal that you could hold in your hand would do the same job of detecting neutrinos as the huge big tank of perchloroethylene in Homestead gold mine. And his papers were published, on this were published. The stuff on the neutrinos got quite a lot of notice and rebuttals because it was fresh. He hadn't, as it were, he wasn't past his sell-by date on the neutrinos. But the stuff on gravity waves also got rebuttals. Why? I was curious to know. Why did his results... I could show you an earlier paper he published in about 1976, which was a big review of all the work he'd done, which nobody ever cited or took any notes of at all. So there was this middle period. So 76 people were taking their notes of Joe Webber. 96 they were taking their notes of Joe Webber, but in the middle period they were taking notes of Joe Webber and rebutting him in the journals and so forth. Why? Anybody guess why? I'll tell you, because it was the time when LIGO was being funded. And everybody was dead scared that if some congressperson read a paper that said we can detect gravity waves in one of these $100,000 rather than barnacles. They won't fund LIGO. So every paper that Joe Rogan was producing that said you could detect gravity waves for $100,000 had to be rebutted. Now, nobody was expecting the Congress people to read the rebuttal papers, but it meant that everybody could go and say to the Congress people when they said, hey, an internet disease result did get into the New Scientist. Hey, how come with you want $250 million if this can be done for $100,000? And they can say, no, that's been rebutted. It's all okay. Okay. So here's another one, strange relationship between physics and its publication.
Well, I'd just like to say it again. If 10 physicists have built 10 Webb of our detectors and found the same effect as him, Joe Webb would have won the Nobel Prize. This never happened.
It might be the case. I don't know if it didn't happen.
It didn't. This was the goal. Well, that's how experimental physics works.
It is the case that some of the other detectors found things consistent with Joe Rogan's work, but they decided not to announce them as gravitational waves. Okay. And to do that, you've got to go into detail. The details are important.
I gathered that a hammer dropped outside the lab. The detector picked it up. I mean,
well,
this is the other issue.
No. That's don't want to go there. The other thing I found out, how did Joe Webber manage to keep going? How did he manage to get funding for these experiments that I described and did in the 1980s? He did experiments on neutrino detection with a torsion balance, and he kept building other gravity wave detectors. How did he get funding? Well, the torsion balance experiments, anyway. He got money from the US Navy. At this point, he couldn't get money from the NSF account, so there would have been an uproar if the NSF had funded him. But Joe Webber said, if I'm right about the detection of neutrinos, then in fact you can use this little crystal to find the reactors of Russian submarines. So the US Navy funded him to do the experiments. And of course they were right. The chances of Joe Webber being right, according to the Orthodox physics community, were pretty well zero. But if he had been right, it would be very important to know. And military budgets are big, and it doesn't matter if $50,000 and so on goes to waste. It's a sensible thing to do. So the curious thing is that if you look at what military budgets are spent on in this country, there's quite a big anti-gravity program. Huntsville, for example.
In which country? In Liverpool.
In Huntsville, Alabama.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you I must say quite big. I mean, it costs $1 million or a couple of million a year. It's money well spent if you can get out there with anti-gravity instead of these big expensive rockets, if you've got plenty of money. And $1 million or two a year does the math too much.
Well, it's funded by who?
DOD. DOD, yeah, something like that. Something with lots of money. And it all makes sense. The curious thing is, if you want to do some really sort of science really out there, don't go to the supposedly blue skies research organizations like the NSF, because they're too much in the thrall of their constituency, which is lots of other scientists in the universities. Go to somebody like the POD or the Navy or something, which doesn't care, doesn't have to answer to those people. And they can find much more outrageous things. Here's another little finding. How do you decide whether to publish a result or not? I found that there are two different approaches to this. There's what I call evidential individualism, which is the idea that you should never publish any experimental result until you're absolutely sure you're right. And there's what I call evidential collectivism, which says, if you get some suggestive results, put them out there and see if other people agree. Okay. This caused a lot of trouble at the time in LIGO, because the evidential individualists, which in this case turned out to be Americans in particular, didn't like what happened to be a group of Italians who started publishing what they considered to be fake results in what they considered to be an attempt to win the Nobel Prize in case they were right, and it didn't matter in case they were wrong. Okay. A lot of serious anger. To me, as a sociologist on the outside, I quite like individual collective. First of all, the same science gets done in here. The only argument about it is who does the assessing. Is the assessing done in private, or is the assessing done in public? So if you're an evidential collective, it's a bit sooner the wider community gets to decide. I think it's actually left to be better than science if the assessing was done in a more public way. Because I actually think there should be more wrong science in the public domain. Does that sound strange? I think there should be more wrong science in the public domain, because I think the public has too high expectations of what science can deliver. I think the public should be more exposed to sort of real, messy laboratory life, so that they won't expect too much, so that they won't be too disappointed and think they're wrong. There's no way. What happened when LIGO got funded? The cryogenic bars. I told you there were two generations of detectors prior to LIGO. There was the room temperature bars, which is sort of they were developed. And there they were the same thing, but cooled down to near absolute zero, a few million degrees. And the cryogenic bar enthusiasts wanted to build another generation of resonant detectors, which would be not bars, but spheres, up to 30 meters in diameter. And spheres would have certain advantages. First of all, they would be very good at detecting the direction from which a wave came from. You put about 6 or 7 transducers on the surface, and by analysing just the way the thing rang, you could tell where it was hit from first. To do it with interferometry, then you need 4 interferometers seeing the same signal to determine which direction the sky is in. With a sphere, you could only be blind. And the sphere proponents reckoned that the spheres would be just as sensitive as the interferometers in a their narrow band range. They've got a very narrow bandwidth, but within that narrow bandwidth, they'd be just as sensitive as the interferometers. The sphere program got killed with LIGO, got funded. My own view is that the sphere program got killed, not because of the technical arguments, because it's quite a good technical argument for having the sphere back to the interferometers. Check that the interferometers are telling the truth and for their directional sensitivity. I think it got killed because it didn't make any political sense to have a much cheaper method of detecting things when you have a very expensive method going on. I think people would probably right to judge that politicians wouldn't make any sense why you needed the second cheaper method to go to jump over the road when you'd already pouring this $200 to $300 million into this gold plating method. I think it was a political judgment dressed up as a technical judgment, but basically a political judgment. What else is in the book? Big story about how the small science of gravitational wave detection turned into the big science of gravitational wave detection, how it needed to be organised by high-energy physicists coming in and knew how to run big science, how the inventor of many of the most ingenious devices in interferometry, Rob Reaver, was squeezed out by this process. And how the whole thing changed. Again, there's no criticism from the obvious. I think it was inevitable. I think one of the reasons that LIGO was so successful is because it was organized in a big science high-energy model. And that's why it's managed to do something in terms of design sensitivity, whereas the other detectors are built in a somewhat more hands-on way by the scientists themselves. Fewer people, less careful organization, and I think it turned out to be such a success. All right, more and more. Let me just go rapidly to this expertise business and then I'll finish. My claim is what I have is this ability to talk and not walk. I call interaction expertise. I actually think this thing called interaction expertise is important all over the place, not just sociologists. I think what a sociologist in the field study like this has to do is get this interaction expertise, but I actually think that the whole scientific world runs with interaction. World runs on interaction expertise. For instance, review committees. The people doing reviews, deciding to fund big projects, do not have the narrow specialist competence to do the science in their judging. They just have the ability to understand the thing in general and talk about it. The managers of big science projects don't have that narrow competence to do the stuff. They only have the ability to talk about it and think about it and so on. There's a lot of extra stuff as well. We can go into it. Any interdisciplinary project by which the narrow specialisms are brought together and talk to each other is interactional expertise, because the members of the two separate specialisms can't actually do what the other person does in each case. They can only get a sense of it and talk about it. Remarkable thing is, though I'm sure that this kind of interactional expertise is much richer and much more detailed than the kind of interactional expertise I've got, heavens, I don't know what a megaparsec is. Nevertheless, it's all the same, cut from the same stuff, that's what I'm claiming. And if you start to think about interactional expertise, hog, you'll see it's actually all over the place. And the scientific needs what we're after. Just thinking about some experiments we did, finish off with. Trying to pin down this thing about interactional expertise, we took colorblind people who don't have the, what I call, contributory expertise of discriminating colors, but have been brought up in a society where everybody's talking about color perception. And we put them with color perceivers in imitation game during test type circumstances to see if the color perceivers could tell the difference between colorblind people and the non-colorblind people by asking them questions. And the answers are they couldn't. We did the same thing as control with people who didn't have perfect pitch, that's most of us, compared with people with perfect pitch perceivers. And the pitch blind people could not imitate the pitch perceivers because they hadn't grown up speaking the language. And finally, I took my courage in my hands when I exposed myself to one of these Turing type tests and tried to pretend to be a gravitational wave scientist. Asked questions by another gravitational wave scientist, with both me and the other gravitational wave scientist giving, and another gravitational wave scientist giving answers. Mostly the gravitational wave scientist thought my answers were better. I can tell you more about that experiment if you want to know. It's quite amusing to me. Thank you.
Questions, comments, listening?
So when you say things like the reason this project got funded or didn't get funded was because of such research, what's your data in there? Is it conversations with people?
Yeah.
It's
intent, it's kind of immersion within the culture. I just talk to people, go to, you know, follow things up, ask people why they did it. I'll ask them, why did you publish it? And somebody will eventually say, well, you know, it was around the time of funding in LIGO, and we wanted to make sure that nobody got the wrong impression.
And you heard that from not just one person, but sufficient number of people to be able to say that.
Yeah, I mean,
it's not interesting.
The thing about the sort of sociological research that I do is that one shouldn't confuse it with a sort of statistical social research where the appropriate level of analysis is a significance test. This is the philosophy of what I do is to try and gain this kind of understanding, a kind of understanding which doesn't require that statistical analysis. Now, surprisingly enough, you can gain huge amounts of understanding. You have to have huge amounts of understanding to function as a member of a society. I remember having this argument once with Gary Sarn, but actually I kind of made this story up. I've embroidered it a bit afterwards, but it goes roughly like this. That Gary Sarn was the project director at LIGO, was once decided to have a go at it and say, you know, you're nothing, it's just anecdotal, you just ask what you think. And I gave him the same sort of advice I'm giving him. No, Gary, if you immerse yourself enough and reflect, you begin to understand the project's quite a lot of the result. We were sitting in Baton Rouge, in the Livingston check, and I said, or at least I wish I'd said, look, Gary, I'll bet you $10 that I can go downtown to Baton Rouge, which is a town I don't know. I can get on the bus, and I can say to the bus driver, look, I want to buy two tickets, one for me and one for the seat next to me, okay? To reserve the seat next to me, and I'll bet you $10 the driver will sell me those two tickets. I've never ridden on a bus in Baton Rouge. I've never ridden on a bus in America. Well, I've ridden on a bus in America once. But I felt sufficient, you can feel sufficiently confident if you understand the society that, in which you're embedded, to be able to make a really robust judgment like that. And I said, what's more, Gary, I know that with more certainty than you're going to know when you, that you detect your gravity wave and you make your detection. So
yeah, I think that's what's certainly still worrying that you are. There is some process which isn't entirely clear by which you come to these judgments. It's not, if you're not doing statistical analysis of data, it's worrying that you're being swayed by your own analysis, not by something more.
I'm exactly what you're saying. I want to say that it's less worrying than you think it is. For example, let's take an example closer to home for you. You know how to form well-formed sentences in English. It's never occurred to you that you should put the verb on the end, as they do in German. Mm-hmm. So if somebody came up to you and said, you are, as an individual, how do you form sentences in English? Verb on the end or verb in the middle? You could tell them with complete certainty that it's not verb on the end. But you don't know why you haven't done it.
I mean, what Lucy is saying now is, this is the reverse. You're driving an argument against science. How do you know the gravitational wave? How do you know about the truth? And this is the reverse thing, right? You're saying it's the truth that they wrote this article because they want to find me their LIGO. And I mean, this is exactly the same thing.
Well, you know, I'll be very proactive. I think that certain of the claims and certain things that you know, as well as me know, about how your society works, are much more robust than any scientific finding. Where you could get me, and you're quite right, when you ask the question, how did you know that this particular paper was published for this particular reason? And I'm hedging a bit there. You know, it's partly detective work, and it's partly this other kind of understanding. And, it's fun.
I haven't followed that. I just wanted to understand the methodology.
Yeah. But to go back to your question, I remember I said I'm not criticizing science. I don't think there's any better way to do it. So I'm just making the same, I'm just providing the same kind of warrants. And I think that scientists, when they make their warrants, are quite right to make the warrants. As long as they describe them right. But it's the best we can do is.
You're also after the truth.
Yeah. Absolutely. I consider myself a scientist.
Two comments. I was going to ask, back in the 1970s, I seem to remember, one of the problems of Joe Weber getting his results accepted, if I remember correctly, was that he adamantly refused to allow other experimentalists to examine independently his detector and his data. Is that correct? That other people reasonably asked him come and look at his data, and he simply, because of his personality or whatever, refused to let people in. Is that correct?
It was at first. But I wouldn't have said, nobody ever told me that was a major reason for their disbelief.
Well, I just vaguely remember that.
Yeah, you're right. You are right. I mean, there are plenty of other reasons. I mean, Joe Robert did make a couple of awful mistakes. For instance, one time he ran his detector in coincidence with the detector of Rochester, and he claimed that he had seen a 2.6 standard deviation correlation in signals between the two detectors. They were a long way apart. And then it turns out that they were actually running on different time standards, so that he created this 2.6 standard deviation out of triggering pure noise. And he made another mistake when he got his computer program wrong. And one of the things that Joe Weber did very badly was to admit mistakes gracefully. Now, people were willing to forgive him for those things because everybody makes mistakes. But if Joe Weber had just sort of put his hand up and said, hey, I got that wrong and that's terrible, people would have had more sympathy for him. So in a sense, it's kind of sociological, even there, psychological. Because Joe Weber didn't know how to admit a mistake gracefully, he gained enemies when he could have not gained enemies. But there are other mistakes. He made a terrible mistake in a conference in Israel quite early on, where he was initially claiming that his high peaks in his rate of detection of gravitational waves were correlated with sidereal time rather than solar time. And he said he found a peak every 24 hours. But actually, since the Earth is transparent to gravitational radiation, it should have been peak every 12 hours. I see. He did things like this. But people, as I said, none of it, the whole story in the book, I looked very carefully at what sort of reasons came together to make people disbelieve things. And none of these single things were decisive. They were decisive for one person here and one person there. But in the end, the thing that kind of triggered it, that made everybody come to deciding wrong, was, it seems to me anyway, according to my analysis, which is vulnerable to what you point out, is Darwin's presentation of his results and Darwin's talking about all these things that Joe Webb did wrong at a company.
Testifying that when you mentioned in 1990 that he had this 9 orders of magnitude.
Yeah.
The only time I ever met Joe Webb was in Aspen around 1993 or something like that. I don't know when he went to be died.
2000.
And he gave me a paper to read, which I think was what you were alluding to, a paper by Preparata. Trimento, which had the cube root of Avogadro's number or something, which is about 9 months of magnitude.
Yeah.
And he asked whether I thought it was right, and I said it was wrong the next day.
Right.
And Joe Weber, who didn't know me, got incredibly angry because he accused me of being part of the conspiracy against him.
Yeah.
Whereas I was just giving an opinion.
He
still believed his data from 30 years earlier.
Yeah, that's right.
And he was then probably 18 or something.
Yeah.
Which I thought was very sad.
Well, my interviews, I interviewed Joe Webb quite a long time. Most of the interviews started with Joe Webb shouting at me. But I actually really liked Joe Webb. And I actually thought the fact that he wouldn't give up was great. And a sort of testament to the human spirit.
Well, I agree.
There's a very sort of fond remembrance of it at the end of the book. And Joe Webb, in spite of everything you say about him, founded the field of gravitational wave detection. I believe that without Joe Webb, you had
it is called the Webb of R.
And it is called the Webb of R in the months and so on. You know, he made a glorious mistake. But in his actual lifetime, as you point out, he did himself no favours by yelling at everybody. The Preparata story is very interesting. Preparata was originally asked to look at Joe Webber's calculations on this cross-section by Amalvi, because Preparata was a very big, as I understand it, important theoretical physicist in Italy. I'm certainly very visible. Preparata originally said Joe Webber's results are wrong and published a paper to that effect. And it was only about 2 years later that Preparata changed his mind and decided that Joe Webber was right. It's quite interesting because I looked at the fate of the papers that said Joe Webber's paper was wrong. The Preparata's paper was never mentioned in any of the subsequent papers that said Joe Webber was wrong. Preparata's paper that said he was wrong was thereafter ignored when Preparata changed his mind, even though the argument was roughly the same. It's the subsequent paper. But it's quite interesting. So when I said wait, what I wanted to know was, is it the case that Preparata was just a sort of hardly visible and flamboyant physicist before he said Joe Webber was right?
Yes.
He was already thought of hardly inflated.
I was an aggressive individual.
I have to accept
He did some very good work in the early 70s.
Right, that's what I thought.
He became a kind of visible and flamboyant.
I'd like to get a certain sequence of dates.
He was always pugnacious.
He was pugnacious before? Yes,
always.
When was his paper written?
Early papers were late 60s.
So he was a pugnacious person?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
I have a first question for you, and then I'll make a comment. Have you yourself signed on to the notion that gravity waves actually exist? Because it sounded like you had it writing an introduction.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not my business, so I have to know that.
That's why I was surprised at you.
I've thought about this quite a lot. As you can see, I know how to not believe in anything. So, but if I were to write a book about how everything to do with gravitational waves can be believed, the book would be as large as the universe. So therefore, I'd have to decide only to not believe in certain narrow things if I'm going to write a finite-sized book. So that, for instance, you'll find in my book there is no discussion of whether a volt meter really works in measure volts or this, that, or the other. Okay. So, as far as I'm concerned, as of now, I can see no particular sociological benefit in not accepting that high fluxes of gravitational waves. That's the fluxes that objects like LIGO are looking for. Sorry, that should say low fluxes of gravitational waves. The sort of fluxes that LIGO essentially are looking for exist. I just act as though those calculations are correct. The earlier physics, even the most radical sociologists have to live in the world, and just accept that most things that people think are true, otherwise they're not wrong.
The reason I said this is, I think building LIGO and looking for gravity waves is one of the most important experiments that can be done. Yeah. But it should not be done on the assumption that gravity waves have to exist. What we know about the decay of the binary pulsar is only that it slows down because each star is affected by the other star. Yeah. We don't know that effect produces radiation which gets out to infinity. We assume it does because of the calculations that follows. But I don't think that you can go directly from seeing the slowdown of the orbit of the binary pulsar to the claim that therefore gravity waves are established, and now we have the opportunity to explore them in detail. I think you have to have an open mind as to whether or not actually the gravity waves really exist.
Yeah, I mean, the numerical calculations that come out of the Hulse Taylor thing fit the theory of part of that.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah. But people just talk about the new range detectors as follows. If current LIGO doesn't see gravitational waves, nobody will be surprised.
That's good.
If advanced LIGO, which looks like it's going to be built, doesn't see gravitational waves, well, people will be surprised, but the surprise will probably be astrophysical rather than physical. In other words, the population of gravitational wave producing events in the sky may not be as great.
The problem is the only one that we think is permanently on is the binary pulsar, and we know that that's true. And so the other one, these cataclysmic events, the two stars collapsing into each other, are so rare and they're so brief that one may not occur in the next 20 years.
Yeah. Well, I think But people think, let's put it another way, you know about LISA, of course, people seem to say that if that doesn't seem to be gravitational waves, then there's real trouble.
Foreign Fullman was here a few days ago, he was studying Foreign Fullman.
Oh, yeah.
And Jorge told the story that I didn't know that a couple of years before the binary pulsar, at a meeting, at a classical general relativity meeting, there was a debate as to whether general relativity predicted that there were gravitational waves. So this is in the 1960s.
Yeah.
And Bryce DeWitt was chairing that meeting, held a vote.
Yeah.
And among experts in general relativity, it was 50-50 whether general relativity, because of these there are issues about the quadrupole formula, which is the formula used to predict the power of gravitational radiation, has never been rigorously derived from general relativity.
It's still not. It's not engaging very.
Jorge's point, and he's too young to have been there, but the kind of story was that experts were evenly split as to whether
as to whether this was a prediction of general, but that is whether the particle formula was true, really, in general relativity, until the binary pulsar results, until the point of binary pulsar results.
Yeah.
And then everybody came to the conclusion that, that with the detection of the binary pulsar, it must be that the particle formula must be right, because that's what gets the slowdown. But I guess this interesting sociological story there of how it is that that all these great mathematical relativists could be so confused about something that we now teach in objects, which is the particle formula.
Well, I didn't know that story, but there's a sort of equivalent much earlier one, which is about, I mean, in the 60s, if I got this right, and this is not my original research, this is Dan Kennedy, who is one of the Kip Thorne students and worked with me for a couple of years, and he's a theoretician. He actually publishes the theory of gravitational waves. He's written papers on this stuff, which was in the 60s. There was serious doubt about whether gravitational waves were detectable in principle. And if I understand it, first of all, there's controversy about what sort of systems would emit gravitational waves. If the systems were in free fall, it wasn't quite clear then where the energy was coming from. I mean, then, you know, it's the orbit in decay, but then it wasn't completely clear. And secondly, whether they were detectable in principle, because if it's a ripple in space-time, doesn't it affect everything? So how is it detectable? And as far as I can understand, the person who put an end to that argument was Jay Weber. And he put an end to the argument, not by some theoretical brilliance, but actually by building a detector. And then people just stopped arguing about it.
Look at it.
Yeah.
Well, can I ask you sort of first, why don't many other people have questions, but to put you sort of back to the theory of science. So you describe very roughly, you know, how a result gets from the detector wiggling to the journals and so forth. And it was some kind of policy, some kind of process of people talking to each other, who trust each other, building a consensus, and then everybody agrees. So, and then you insist that, you know, this kind of criticism, there's no other way to do it. But this is, you know, very unlike previous descriptions, like say Popper or, you know, other people. And there is still the demarcation. I don't know if the demarcation problem is the right word, or I'm using the wrong word. But you know, what do we do when a group, you know, with intelligent design, say, who are a group of people who have PhDs in biochemistry-related subjects, and claim that yes, they're doing science, or people who say there's no evidence for global warming. I mean, if it's all just consensus in the community, do we have any ammunition against people who say we're a community, we're smart people, and we come to this other conclusion?
It's exactly the sort of problem which certainly troubles me a great deal. First of all, even though it's consensus within the community, it's not consensus within any community. Now, one of the things that makes the community work well in the way it does is its myths. So I think it's completely wrong for people to get the notion that, well, because this is all a matter of consensus, any way of forming consensus is as good as any other. If people started saying, well, we're going to make sure that loop quantum gravity wins the argument with string theories by going around shooting all the string theorists, we wouldn't be doing science. So there's a certain sort of, I would claim that there's a certain sort of set of activities that mark out science as a Western science, the kind of music activity. I think it's very, very hard to say what they are. But I think we shouldn't give up trying to say what they are. And I think we have to say what they are, precisely so that we can show that things like intelligent design don't belong.
So do you have a, what would be your list of what they are?
Well, I mean, it's funny because at the moment I'm writing a paper precisely on this, and it's one of my colleagues, to my great horror,
is currently in Harrisburg being a witness to the defense for intelligent design in the trial. Possibly could speak fuller. And what was fortunate, it was this thing that was a bit flaky, but has now, you know, filled this major airport vacuum, and he's filled one of these holes which we didn't think anybody would ever fill. So he's doing this. And it's quite easy. I mean, I've read the deposition, and I've read his cross examination, and I can see how he does it. And his cross examination, by the way, he uses a bit of straight up and down pop up. He says that the context of justification is different from the context of discovery. So it doesn't matter why these people are claiming there's gaps in evolutionary theory, so long as the mathematical proof that people, that the eye or whatever, the tail of this flagellum or whatever it is too complex to be explained by evolutionary theory, is scientifically sound. That's scandalously for a modern philosopher of science to say, because we all know that the context of discovery, the context of justification are not separate. That in fact what you want to find affects what you do find. Some extent. So I'm amazed that he's actually said that. But the other thing he does is very much more standard kind of sociology of scientific knowledge. He points to some of the contents that have been in science in the past, as you probably know, Newton and Alchemist. Probably spent more time pursuing alchemy than anything else. So he said, well, if you come to alchemist, why can't these be complete creationists? And so on, all this kind of stuff. And it's quite hard work having to find the people
who wasn't a successful alchemist.
Well, he wasn't an
alchemist. He was also a creationist.
Exactly, so. Exactly. And the best argument that I'm managing to come up with at the moment is you have to say that all activities in science have a family resemblance to each other. They don't. And if you've got family resemblance, this is Wittgenstein, by the way, definition of game. You know, you can't define what a game is, because you can say every game has a family resemblance to every other. In other words, if you draw it like a set of two and four, a set of circles, students and ellipses. So each member of the family, you know, has a big nose, has a same colored hair and so on. But as you move out to the end of the family, this one may have very little in common with this one. So Tiddly Winks has got very, very little to do with American football, they're both games. But it would be hard to find the defining criteria which links them. And what Fuller has done, and Mark Fuller's in my analysis, is to take the family too far back in time, and he also imagines what science might be like in the future in his defense. And it seems to me that if you can get anywhere with this, you've got to restrict the family of science as we currently know them. And then you can show that creationism doesn't have any overlap, so long as you also don't accept that there's a rigid distinction between the context of discovery and the context of justification. So there's one kind of thing. And I talked to you about another one in the office earlier that I wanted to get down.
One very quick comment. I think it's in the introduction to Gottfried and Weisskopf. Weisskopf talks about the fact that as well as a written tradition, science has a moral tradition.
Let me, this is a conversation that can go on and will go on, and for example, could go on over dinner if anybody wants to join. But let me see if it's just a quick question from somebody who hasn't raised a question, or only raised one.
So I'm kind of curious, to what extent do you think people tell the truth about their reasons for publishing a paper? For instance, do people tell you, well, I published that paper, I know it's not very good, but, you know, I was trying to get tenure.
People tell me the truth. People don't tell all sorts of stuff. But on the whole, people tell me the truth. But it's been hard work. You know, they tell me the truth because I go to all the meetings, I'm always around, and as far as I can, I've just become a gang. They also know, the people who know me, that I will immediately know if they're not telling the truth, and so on and so forth. I mean, you've got to do this by immersing yourself in it. I've had one or two interviews where not many people have not told the truth. And I've known that. There was one very interesting one which I'm going to write about one day, when somebody told me a pack of lies from beginning to end about why a grant was given to a certain researcher. As soon as he started telling me this story, I see it with wrong. Okay. And I challenged him about that. I said, that can't be right because of this and this and this.
And then he changed the story a bit and so on. And I said, okay, this is how I'm going to tell the story. And it was, if I told it that way, it would have been very embarrassing. So he kind of changed it again. And he eventually produced a story which I could accept. And then I went into the comedy at the office of one of his colleagues, just down the corridor, and asked about the same thing. And he told me for a different story, which, because of the content of it, was obviously correct, because of the, you can tell it's the correct one when it's the story that does you the least favourite. That is most damaging to your reputation of the storyteller. And I went away and I thought about this for a long, long time, because I thought, well, wait a minute, if I hadn't gone into this second office, I would have gotten acceptable but wrong stories. Okay. So this is your kind of worry. How is it possible for me to be badly, you know, get the whole thing completely wrong? And I eventually decided it didn't matter, because I'm not a detective. I'm not a detective. What I'm trying to work out is how the scientific world works. And to know how the scientific world works is not the same as to know which individual is telling the truth. You've got to know which stories are plausible, not which stories are true. So this is how I now try to explain this to students and so on and so forth, I suppose. So imagine I was in Birmingham, England, watching a ballroom dancing competition, not knowing what ballroom dancing was. And I said to my native informant, when I watched two people dancing a tango, what are they doing? And then I imagine the native informant gives me three possible replies. Reply one, they're engaged in surreptitious sexual delicates. They're not actually man and wife, but they kind of like each other, and they're dancing a tango so that they can get physically close to each other. The second answer that the respondent might give me is, oh, they're trying to win Celio Latin American ballroom dancing competition. Okay? And the third answer that informant gives me is, they're trying to bring on rain. Okay. Now, what I better know as a sociologist is that the third answer is implausible, and that the first two answers are plausible. Because either of the first two answers, whether they're true or not, tell me how the society works. Whereas the third answer doesn't tell me how the society works, it's misleading. So actually, if I'd gone out of the office with the wrong story about how this guy's been funded, it wouldn't have mattered too much, because it was a plausible story. Would it matter if I was a historian, or if I was a private detective, or if I was going to give evidence in a law court? But if what I'm writing about is how this society works, it doesn't matter so long as it makes reasonable sense. So I call that, glorify this with the name of the anti-forensic principle. So what you've got to make sure is your descriptions don't turn on which individuals at any particular time are telling you the truth. The thing must be much more about mechanisms than individual motives, because individual motives are really too hard to find out about. As you know, watch law courts. They spend weeks and weeks and weeks trying something, and they still can't work out what the person really had intent when they voted something.
That's gauging variance. I'll say that's
gauging
variance.
Explain what your view is on the importance of science and the extent to which it should be funded. If say, things like gravitational wave detection, if they're largely just a group of people negotiating some consensus, I mean, is that worth spending $300 million on? And
well, first of all, science is dirt cheap, I suppose. The detection of gravitational waves finally happens, it probably cost about the same as a wing tip of the stealth fighter. Yeah. So $300 million is not a lot of money, but it's the sort of money the government spent. Mm. And the thing is glorious. You know, why wouldn't you want science if you want arms? Whatever it is, it's the most glorious part of our project. So, I mean, I'm not so sure that I'm happy about the money that's spent on trips to Mars and the space station, for all the reasons that you're not very happy about. Okay. That seems to me. But the reason is not because it's money being spent on science, but because it's money being spent on really non-science, you know, not very efficient science and so on and so forth. But when it's real science like this, I you know, what's the point of I get this from Ernest Hemingway, actually, in one of his books tells a story about meeting, crossing a bridge somewhere in the middle of Europe, just after the Second World War, and meeting a lady, a Swiss lady, in a hat with lots of flowers for birds, crossing the bridge and meeting him and saying, "Oh, it was terrible, the war, Mr. Hemingway. We couldn't get cream cakes." And Hemingway was initially sort of felt angry about this, about somebody saying this, and then he said, "Well, wait a minute. In the end, we do want cream cakes, don't we? I mean, there's no point in living. We don't just want subsistence." And yeah, we want science is in a cream cake. There's no point in living.
Okay, well, this is a nice little slant.
So isn't the gravitational wave community different because most of them know you?
Most of them are?
Most of them know you. So you might have, you spent a lot of time talking to these guys, you've made them think about their motivation and that there's something you might have made them better scientists, made them a different sort of scientists. Do you think that's happened, or do you don't think so?
Well, let me answer it in two ways. Let me answer it first of all in the sort of general way, because it is a problem that social scientists grapple with. I mean, the traditional problem for the participant observer is supposed to be that you affect the situation and kind of Heisenberg principle writ large. And I puzzled a lot about this when I did some early experiments with parapsychology, where we were observing children who believed they were friends through after flashing a mirrored gun. And what I did to participant observer with a physicist colleague of mine at the University of Bath was to do some observing children in the psychology laboratory, and we photographed them from behind one-way mirrors. And I could see that my physicist colleague was mucking up these experiments because he kept going into the laboratory and walking in front of the camera lens so that if he had seen any spoon bend, then the thing wouldn't have any validity because there'd been a moment when the spoon was hidden from the camera. And so I thought to him, well, if I tell him not to do this, I'm disturbing the experiment which I'm supposed to be observing. But if I don't tell him not to do this, and for some reason some spoon does bend, then we're not going to have any interesting data. And so I literally decided to tell him, look, so you can't walk in front of that lens, walk around the back, otherwise we're not going to have anything interesting. And then I sort of justified this, and the conclusion is, if you really want to be a participant observer, you've got to participate. You can't pretend to not participate. Therefore, you are in a disturbed situation, but you better make sure that the conclusions you reach are not of a kind that's going to be mucked up by the extent to which you've participated. Now, in the particular case of gravitational wave detection, I wish I had affected the community to some extent. First of all, the bugger will never admit that I'm affected in any way. And secondly, I'm not sure that I have affected it very much. And thirdly, that even if I had, I'd be delighted to worry about it.
Okay, you're not going to say the bugger is the biggest.
Okay, just a quick follow-up. I think people who want to continue to expand come down. I'd like to thank everybody.